From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, wildlife conservationist Alan Rabinowitz on tracking the endangered jaguar. He says you don't sneak up on the cat, it sneaks up on you. Rabinowitz is featured in the new National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar. As a child, he was drawn to animals because he had a severe stutter. Also, Irish filmmaker Jim Sheridan. His new movie, In America, is based in part on his own experiences arriving broke in New York City during a sweltering summer with his wife and two daughters. Sheridan is best known for his films My Left Foot and In the Name of the Father. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles singer Lee Dorsey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that the transfer of power to a new Iraqi government could take place before the country has a new constitution.
There has been concern expressed that the time required to write a constitution, if you are going to go through an election process to determine who should be on that constitutional writing commission, could eat up a great deal of time, more time than we think can be allowed before we start transferring sovereignty back.
Up until now, the administration has insisted that the Iraqis draft a constitution and hold elections before the U.S. would return power. Powell and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice began talking up the new position today after 2 days of meetings with Paul Bremer, the top U.S. civilian administrator in Iraq. A group representing some of the relatives of victims of the 9/11 terror attack says it's unhappy with the agreement struck yesterday between the White House and an independent commission looking into the attacks. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The independent commission says it needs to see the daily presidential briefs to determine what, if any, warnings were given about possible attacks. The White House has been reluctant to share the sensitive documents, but the commission Wednesday announced a compromise. It reportedly would allow two commission members full access to the classified documents, but place restrictions on how that information is shared with the rest of the panel. The Family Steering Committee, which represents relatives of 9/11 victims, called the arrangement unacceptable. It said all 10 panel members should have access to the documents, and the public should be told how and why the agreement was reached. Some commission members are also unhappy with the deal, but others say it will give the panel the information it needs. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich says the Bush plan to lower prescription drug costs for seniors amounts to a privatization of Medicare. Karen Schaefer reports from member station WCPN in Cleveland.
President Bush says it's time to modernize the Medicare system. He's calling on Congress to pass a Medicare reform bill that would give seniors a much-needed price break on prescription drugs. The Bush plan would also expand health care choices for older Americans by encouraging private insurers to offer more options. But Democratic presidential contender Dennis Kucinich charges that insurance companies and the drug industry are responsible for skyrocketing medical costs.
Profits for the insurance industry, profits for the pharmaceutical companies, corporations making a great deal of money and heaping misery on average citizens.
Kucinich favors creating a universal health care system that would lower drug prices for all Americans. For NPR News, I'm Karen Schaefer in Cleveland.
In stocks, the Dow lost 11 points to close at 98.38. This is NPR News. Damaging winds have moved from the Midwest into the Northeast. People in the Buffalo, New York area are bracing for blizzard-like conditions that could bring several inches of snow. Eileen Buckley reports from member station WBFO.
Strong winds with gusts exceeding 60 miles an hour have been whipping along the shores of Lake Erie in Buffalo. So far, the winds are to blame for some scattered power outages. But forecaster Tom Nizial says as the snow begins to fall, it will generate blizzard-like conditions and lake-effect snows.
There will be periods in which the snowfall and the winds will combine to drop those visibilities down below a mile at times.
The calendar may still say fall, but in Buffalo, a winter weather advisory is posted, and a winter storm warning is in effect for areas well south of the city. The storm could produce the first significant snowfall of the season for parts of the region. For NPR News, I'm Eileen Buckley in Buffalo.
An Alabama court has removed the state's chief justice from office. The court found that Chief Justice Roy Moore willfully and publicly refused to obey a federal court order that he remove a stone monument depicting the Ten Commandments from the state's judiciary building. The federal court said that Moore's display of a religious text in a government building was a violation of the constitutional separation of church and state. After today's decision, the ousted Chief Justice told supporters that he had no regrets. Moore was elected Chief Justice in 2000 and was in the middle of a six-year term. In stocks today, the Nasdaq lost 5 points to close at 1,967. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Jewish World Service, working to end poverty, build self-sufficiency, and spread human dignity throughout the world. AJWS.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. People sometimes think that there are no unexplored places left on Earth, but there are still explorers, and wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz is emphatically one of them. He scaled the remote highlands bordering the Himalaya Mountains. He's tracked jaguars in Belize and leopards in the rainforests of Thailand, all with one goal in sight: to preserve vast tracts of wilderness as habitat for endangered species. Rabinowitz is the director of the Science and Exploration Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society, based at the Bronx Zoo. He's the author of a number of books that read more like scientific adventure stories than nature writing. They include Jaguar, Chasing the Dragon's Tail, and Beyond the Last Village. While Rabinowitz has researched many large mammals, he's focused primarily on large cats, leopards, tigers, and jaguars, and is in the process of trying to establish a corridor of protected habitat for jaguars that would stretch from Mexico to Argentina. This project is the subject of a National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar, airing November 26th on PBS. I asked Alan Rabinowitz what distinguishes jaguars from other big cats.
Jaguars are considered one of the three great cats in the world. They're the third largest cat after tigers and lions, and they're considered one of the top predators in the entire world. In the Western Hemisphere, they are the largest cat, and they're the top predator. So they're a major focus of my research, and always have been, because by studying the thing that's number one, that's the top of the food chain of the ecosystem, we can get at everything else below it. So when I do research on jaguars, find out how large an area they need to live, how large a space we need to protect them, what I'm actually getting at is not just trying to save jaguars, I'm actually trying to save intact, whole ecological systems or ecosystems.
Where can jaguars be found in the wild now?
Currently, jaguars range from northern Mexico to northern Argentina. They used to come up into the United States. We do have recent evidence that some jaguars are actually coming from the Mexican populations over the border into southern Arizona, southern New Mexico. So jaguars may, in fact, be able to come back in the southern United States at some point in the future if we protect them. But currently, they reside from Mexico to Argentina.
Well, does their species face more challenges or different challenges to survival than other large cats? Are they in a category of their own in terms of that?
In some ways, jaguars are in a category of their own. Saving them presents a lot of the same challenges that saving other large cats does in terms of saving large areas of habitat, trying to stop people from hunting them. In some ways, saving jaguars is a bit of an easier task than, say, trying to conserve tigers, because we're dealing with almost one uniform cultural unit where jaguars occur throughout Central and South America. Whereas with tigers, we're dealing with fragmented populations scattered over many different countries with different languages and political systems. But they're tougher to protect in that they occur in areas where there's a lot of human conflict, a lot of private land. It's not as easy to buy or set up large protected areas for the jaguars as it is for some of the other cats. So it's a balance.
You say in the National Geographic documentary that one of the problems contributing to the jaguar's endangerment is that people think they're more dangerous than they really are, maybe because we don't know as much about them. But what have you observed in the field that makes you so sure they're not really that dangerous?
Well, beyond having actually captured numerous jaguars and followed them, followed the ones which I've captured and radio collared myself through the jungle for years, I've actually tracked jaguars numerous times, and on at least two occasions, I turned around to return to my camp, and the jaguar I was tracking was, in fact, right in back of me, tracking me. It had circled around, and I know this because I went back the next day and actually followed the tracks of the animal I saw right in back of me, and it turned out to be the same jaguar, which had circled around and was simply walking in back of me for quite a distance, because basically it was curious. It was following me to find out why I was following it. And often people will tell stories about being stalked by them or being followed by them. Well, in actual fact, jaguars are curious, and in all likelihood, the jaguar was following them out of curiosity, because if a big cat like a jaguar wants to attack you, you probably will never see it coming. And if you even see it coming, it'll only be seconds before it hits you that you'll see it coming. So to be aware that an animal is following you or close by means it's not really trying to get at you.
Well, I was just going to ask you that because it's so intriguing what you're saying about the jaguar's curiosity. On the other hand, it's so creepy to know you're out there.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can know it's really an interesting thing, especially when I would try to call jaguars in at night. I would actually sit up in a tree or sometimes at the base of a tree and use a jaguar caller, a special instrument made by the local people, which is supposed to simulate their vocalizations. And you would know a jaguar was coming in when all of the night sounds would stop closer and closer. They wouldn't stop all at once. You would hear them stopping in the distance and then stopping closer and closer to you, but you would never see the jaguar or never hear the jaguar. And then when I heard all sounds stop around me, then I would turn on a flashlight, and more often than not, there would be the jaguar right there looking at me.
What do you mean right there? In a tree nearby or what?
No, either usually it'd be me who was in the tree. I'd be in the tree only once I actually couldn't get up in a tree and we stayed down on the ground, which I didn't like very much. And the jaguar would come within about 10 feet and I could see it and it could see me. Or sometimes it'd be in the rainforest around me and I could hear it walking around trying to figure out what I was doing once it realized that I wasn't another jaguar.
Okay, now what happens the moment after you shine your flashlight and you see the jaguar looking back at you?
Only once did the jaguar actually make a vocalization, which I don't even think was an aggressive vocalization. Simply, I think it was a bit pissed off at me. I think it was annoyed that I had brought it in, and then it realized I was just a human being. But usually, just like when I've encountered jaguars in other situations, it would look at me curiously, trying to figure out something for a few seconds, and then it would simply walk off into the jungle. I'd be shaking. I'd be pretty scared, or at least humbled. Not always scared, but just feeling like I was in the presence of something much greater than myself.
I'm talking with Alan Rabinowitz. He's a wildlife biologist and a conservationist. His work with jaguars in Central and South America is profiled in a new National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar. It airs November 26th on PBS. I want to talk about some of the conservation work you've done in Asia. And I know you've worked to preserve wildlife in Burma. It's known as Myanmar. What's happened to the tiger population there? That was the species you were looking at.
Working in Myanmar has been one of the most incredible experiences of my life. I've been involved there since 1993. It's going on 10 years now. And that country always fascinated me, as well as many other biologists, because for the region of Asia, it has more forest left in it than any country in the Indo-Pacific realm. And in the past, it was thought to be home of about 7,000 animal species or more. Potentially, from the amount of forest which it had when I first went there, I thought it could have, or did have, the second largest tiger population outside of India, with the potential of having more tigers than any other country in the world. That started off a lot of other research over the years, but we did spend about 3 years surveying tigers throughout the entire country, which is not an easy task. Most of the tigers have been killed off in the country by local groups who were funneling the tiger parts mostly over the border into China for the Chinese trade in traditional medicines. But they did have some tigers left. We estimated that the whole country had perhaps 150 tigers left, which is pitiful for a place which once had hundreds of thousands of tigers in the past and still had lots of forest left for tigers. But it was good data to get, because that spurred us on and spurred the government on to try to do something to reverse this trend and do something about it. And that led to what I'm involved in right now, which could be one of the greatest conservation accomplishments of my life, and I think could be one of the best models in the world, setting up a tiger reserve of approximately 8,000 square miles in northern Myanmar by the India border, which will be by far the largest tiger reserve any place in the world, and has the best population of tigers left in the country, which could potentially expand outward and fill the country up again.
My guest is conservationist Alan Rabinowitz. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz. His work to preserve habitat for jaguars in South America is the subject of an upcoming National Geographic special on PBS. Rabinowitz has also worked with leopard populations in Thailand and tigers in Burma, also known as Myanmar. While you were in Myanmar, you made a 500-mile trek across lands that very few Westerners have traveled in. So what kind of terrain were you going through, and what kind of cultures did you come across?
Well, that area up there is it's a fascinating terrain because, well, it's incredibly mountainous. It's the southeast edge of the Himalayan mountains. It's where the Himalayas end and smack up against what's called the China Plateau to the east. It's one of the most unknown areas zoologically in the world because nobody has been allowed up there because of various politics. Even the government itself wasn't. When I went up into that area, not only did the local people say it was the first time they had seen a Westerner, but it was the first time they had met a central Burmese person, a Burman from the capital city area, because people from most of Burma couldn't get up into that area because of insurgency. And only in 1994 was a peace treaty signed with the local insurgents so that it was open to other people in the country. But the terrain was incredibly rugged. It was just walking up and down. There was virtually no flat area to be walking. You were either always going uphill or downhill. And you would try to stay in villages. There were local villages back up in there, small settlements. They were always in the river valleys, in between the ups and the downs.
You've written a book about this trek, Beyond the Last Village. And in it, you write that in many of these villages, their greatest necessity is salt. And that they, at least one peoples, eat a meat of a primitive species that's little known outside the region.
Yes, in fact, well, there are two things there. One was the fascinating fact that this is one area of the world where there are no natural sources of salt to be found. And you really realize how important salt is to the lives of human beings, although we take it for granted, of course, because salt is on every table in a restaurant. But in this part of the world, people will die without salt. People hunt for salt. People base their lives around obtaining enough salt for the year and obtaining it for themselves and for their livestock. They will often spend months out hunting rare endangered species to trade with Chinese traders just to get salt. So it was a very interesting thing to realize, as well as opening up a lot of doors for me when trying eventually to figure out how do I protect this area, how do I help these local people, what can we do to both help the wildlife and help the people. Salt became the major issue. Now, in terms of what the people eat, it was fascinating because not only are they up in this area, since we did the first zoological survey, we indeed found many rare endangered Himalayan species like red panda, which people know about, occurring there in abundance, but also some species which people know almost nothing about and have not even heard of, like takin or black barking deer. And we even discovered a completely new species to science, the second smallest deer in the world, which the local people called the leaf deer.
So I have to ask you, how small is it?
The leaf deer stands full adult size. It stands about 20 inches, and it has antlers, which at their maximum size are only 1 inch long. And the people call it leaf deer in their own language. It's called pedji, which means leaf deer, meaning that when they kill one of these, they could wrap its entire body inside of a single large leaf of one of the local plants they use. And in fact, I ended up going back the next year because during that first survey, I didn't really have time other than finding parts of this new species and realizing there's a new species up here and then getting it identified genetically back in New York. But then I went back the next year with my wife, who's a geneticist, and we stayed among that group of people who hunted this deer and actually watched them and studied them alive. And that was just an incredible experience.
I know that as a child you suffered from a severe stutter, and that's in large part how you came to do the work that you do. When it sounds exhausting, when you're working in the field, do hours and hours, even days perhaps, go by where you don't have to talk? Is that like a respite for you?
Yes, and that's partly why I chose my field initially. It's a very complex... I chose my field partly because I loved animals and I felt a special bond towards animals. And I chose not only to work and study animals, but to run away to the furthest reaches of the world, not just to go in my backyard or stay in the United States and study animals, but I wanted to study animals in the furthest hidden away spots and cultures where people didn't speak English. So I didn't have to talk to them, or I'd learn another language, and I thought perhaps I won't stutter in another language, or to where I would just be alone in the jungle or in the forest following animals for days, weeks, months at a time, and barely, if ever, have to speak to anybody. That's exactly why I did it, and it's exactly what happened. For years after first going out into the forest, I would do just that. I would stay with animals, I would radio call them, follow them, live in the forest, and I wouldn't have to speak to anybody. Sometimes there would be local people around me, but we would communicate using hand signals if I didn't know their language. When I worked in Thailand, I eventually learned Thai. And that's when I learned over the years that if you speak well enough in a language and you're a stutterer, you will stutter in that language also. Because there came a day when I started stuttering in Thai as well.
Fate is so cruel.
Yeah. That's right. But that is exactly why I was drawn. It's a fairly complex reason. So many people have an easy answer when asked, why do you do what you do when it's working with animals? And they answer because they've always loved animals for their entire life. Mine's a very complex answer because it involved a lot of different things, both in myself and in my relationship with animals.
I know you were diagnosed 2 years ago with leukemia. How is your health now?
I was diagnosed with leukemia, with a slow-acting form of leukemia, chronic lymphatic leukemia, which has no known cure to it right now, but also can progress very slow. It can speed up also. They don't know. It's just a big question mark how much longer until I might need treatment for it.
Well, when you got your diagnosis, did your doctor sit you down and say, look, we know you trek through Burma for your work and you track down jaguars and tigers. That just has to stop.
Actually, no. I was very pleased. The doctors were a bit stymied. They said, you know, normally when we diagnose somebody of your age and at this early stage with leukemia, with this kind of leukemia, we tell them to just go about life as normal and don't change anything in your life. But your life is not normal, they said to me. They said, you've got us a bit stumped here because we want to tell you, go about your life as normal. But the fact is that if you get sick, because I've often got, from all my years in the field, I've gotten very sick on numerous occasions, because there's no way to live with local people for such a long time as I do and not get things like malaria or typhoid or dengue or scrub typhus, and I've had all of those things. And what the doctors are worried about now is that it's possible, though they don't know if this will definitely happen, that if I get very sick again while I'm out in the field, it could speed the disease up. It could, since it kicks my immune system into overdrive trying to heal myself, it will create more white blood cells and it could speed things along. So they were caught between saying, look, go about life as pretty much normal, but try hard not to get as sick as you have in the past.
How much time do you spend in the field now?
Well, I spend now, it was only when I was 40 that I decided to take some time off from the field and get married. And since I've been married, actually it's since I've had my first child at 46 in the last few years, I've cut down a bit my time away in the field. Now I spend maybe 6 months a year in the field, whereas before it was virtually 95 to 100% of my time.
Well, I just want to say I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish you Godspeed and good luck with your work.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a true pleasure to speak with you today. It's been wonderful.
Wildlife biologist Alan Rabinowitz. His work is the focus of a National Geographic special, In Search of the Jaguar. It airs November 26th on PBS. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, director Jim Sheridan. His own life is the inspiration for his new film, In America, but it took him 10 years to make, and it took the help of his daughters to get the story right. And Ed Ward remembers Lee Dorsey, singer, boxer, and Fender and Body Man. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Jim Sheridan is best known for directing, writing, and producing movies inspired by the history and politics of his native Ireland. His films include My Left Foot, The Field, In the Name of the Father, The Boxer, Some Other Son, and Agnes Brown. His new film, however, is based largely on his own life. In America draws on experiences Sheridan had when he moved with his family from Ireland to New York City in the 1980s. It's about a husband and wife who have two young daughters. They come to New York still grieving the loss of their third child, Frankie, who died of a brain tumor. Here's a clip. In this scene, the girls have just been given an award at their school for the best homemade Halloween costumes. As they walk home with their parents, one of the girls throws her award in the trash.
Ah, you can't throw away your prize. Best homemade costume.
They made it up because they pity us.
You got it because you're different.
We don't want to be different. We want to be the same as everybody else.
Why would you want to be the same as everybody else?
Because everybody else goes trick-or-treating.
What's that?
It's what they do here for Halloween.
What do you mean, like have the Halloween party?
No, not help the Halloween party. You don't ask for help in America, you demand it. Trick or treat, you don't ask, you threaten.
You can't do that in our street.
Why not?
Because you can't threaten drug addicts and transvestites, that's why.
What are transvestites?
Man dresses up as a woman.
For Halloween?
No, all the time. All the time.
Why? It's just what they do here, okay?
Jim Sheridan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Yeah, great. It's good to be back.
This film is so much more directly autobiographical than your previous movies. What made you decide to tell this story now?
I've been working on it for about 10 years more since My Left Foot. And I wrote a couple of drafts because the stories were quite funny and the anecdotes were great. And then I gave it to my daughters because I didn't have a theme, thinking maybe they'd come up with a theme for a film. And what they did was eliminate my character from their stories.
That's so telling.
I disappeared, and I was just a guy who embarrassed them by turning up at school with a plastic bag on his head when it was raining, and sang the words to songs he didn't know. And when I had a few drinks, I'd tell them I loved them. And that was about it. That was my role in the family. And it's a kind of humbling experience. So I took the kids' perspective and put that with my own. But I still didn't have a story. And then I decided to incorporate the story of my brother who died. But I transferred it to my son and gave the emotions of myself to the daughter in the film. And I realized when I did it that it gave me a dual perspective on myself and my daughter. And without that, you know, you've got these flat personalities because it's very hard to write about yourself.
The story takes place after Frankie, the family's third child, who's only 5 years old, has died of a brain tumor. And mm-hmm. you dedicate the film to your brother, Frankie, who died also of a brain tumor when he mm-hmm. was young. How old were you when your brother passed away?
I was 17 and he was 10 in actuality. He fell down the stairs when he was about 7 or so. And he, you know, he had a big black head and he recovered. But it had caused a tumor in his brain, which nobody detected. And that became, you know, that grew like octopus-like. And when they opened him up, it was too deep to save him.
Were you able to spend much time with your brother during his illness?
Yeah. In a way, I often think I was the first to realize there was something wrong with him, because out of the blue, I took him to the pictures and bought him a ice cream called the Knickerbocker Glory. And, you know, it's one with a long spoon and about 10 colors with a cherry on top. And I always remember him smiling at me. And for years, I thought, wasn't it great I brought him out to get him an ice cream when I'd never brought any of my brothers to anything. And gradually I realized that it was his smile I remembered, because it wasn't actual. And, you know, the human face has 800 muscles. And the only thing
that we can't do consciously is make a true smile. That seemingly the conscious mind can't smile unless it's actually authentic, deeper. And so false smiles are like that thing you see without the eye muscles engaged. Now, I knew when he was smiling at me, as I was saying knicker and bocker, that he was actually smiling, but it looked probably like something else. So I don't know how, but it stayed with me that maybe at that moment I knew subconsciously something was wrong.
So this was before, this was after the accident, before any diagnosis had been made?
Before any diagnosis. He starts slowing down slightly, like his motor functions just slightly got impaired. And my mother brought him to the doctor, and the doctor said, you better take him to hospital.
Well, in the film, the father, Johnny, he struggles not only financially to support his family. He's trying to get work as an actor in New York. But he also has trouble emotionally. He just can't feel anything since the loss of his son. And he says in one scene that he's just a ghost. How did your father deal with the loss of your brother, of his son? And did he retreat into his work?
He was always retreating into his work. My father got up at 8:30. He went to work at 9:00. He came back at 6:00. He got his tea. He went to work at 7:30. He came back at 11:00. I met a man on a train recently, and he was looking at me, and my wife said, don't make eye contact, because what would happen is I go over and talk to him, and he would tell me the story of, you know, everybody comes up to you and says, you should make a story about our street. And I go, yeah. And they say, Mrs. O'Brien in number 10, she had 12 kids. The eldest went off to the war, and you'd have to listen to the story of the 12 kids. And then they'd inevitably be saying, if you think that's mad, Mrs. Tittle next door, she had 14 kids. And you'd have to listen to those stories. So you with great fear, you make contact. So this man, I went over to him as the train was pulling in, and he said to me, you know, I worked for your dad. I worked with your dad in the GNR, which was the Great Northern Railway. He said, and in the morning, we'd sell tickets to Galway and Belfast. And at lunchtime, we'd go down to the old folks. And he was Dean Martin and I was Frank Sinatra. So my father went to work in the morning. At lunchtime, he organised the old folks. He came back at 6:00. He worked Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, and Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, he did the old folks or the drama group or the plan given for the church. And on Saturday during the morning, he brought the children from the Sheriff Street to the play, to the Bats. So he never stopped.
What was it like directing this film in which you're directing a character that's partially based on your father and also on you? What did you say to this actor, Paddy Considine, who plays
I didn't,
his part?
I didn't put anything on him, you know. I just let him build a character, you know, from the words and actions. I didn't have him imitate me, but...
Did you in fact say, don't watch me, don't imitate me?
No, all actors watch the director. Most actors are the director, you know, because, like, although John Wayne doesn't look like John Ford, he's actually playing John Ford. So... There is a there's an osmosis or symbiosis or whatever the osis is that happens, you know. But playing my father was weird because sometimes I would be pointing at the screen and say, that's exactly what my father would do. And it was actions that I had actually done, do you know what I mean?
Can you give us an example?
Well, playing for the, trying to win the E.T. doll when I lost that story. I lost the money.
Now, you're talking about in the film, the family has left the apartment building because it's so hot, and they go to the movies, and they see E.T., and then they walk through the streets of New York, and they end up at walking through an Italian street fair, like the Festival of San Gennaro or something, and the daughter sees an E.T. doll, and she wants it, and so the father bets pretty much everything, the rent money, everything, to win this doll, throwing balls into a basket.
Yeah.
That happened?
Yeah, that happened. Because my kid wanted it, so I was going to win it. And I got up to only $16 or $32, and I had 7 balls to get in the hole, and I'd got 6 of them. and I got up to 128 and I still only had 6. But I would point at that scene and say that's exactly like my father, because what gives it the tension is not quite just the father trying to win it. It's the daughter's attitude towards the gambling, you know? And that's really my attitude towards my father. He used to go to the races, and at the races he had to win, you know? Because if he won, it meant he was right about everything in life. And if he lost, it meant he was a complete idiot, you know? And he would behave in completely irrational terms if he didn't win. Like, he mightn't switch the heat on in the car going home. He was just crazy about that stuff. And he was a very loving guy, but, you know, the races meant a hell of a lot to him.
But you stopped, it sounds like. You didn't win when you bet. You got up to $128 and then you walked away?
No, I lost.
You lost, right.
Yeah, and I had $2 left. But what I mean, it's disconcerting to be still blaming your father at my age for actions that you took yourself in your life. So, you know, it just proves that I have this saying, everybody either blames their mother or their father, you know? And great actors blame both.
I'm talking with screenwriter, director, and producer Jim Sheridan. His new film is In America, and his other films include My Left Foot, The Field, In the Name of the Father, and The Boxer. Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is filmmaker Jim Sheridan. His new movie is called In America, and it's about a young family, an Irish family, who's mourning the death of their young son. They come to New York City to start a new life. I want to be sure that we talk about the two actors who play the role of the young sisters in the film. They are sisters themselves, Sarah and Emma Bolger. They're fantastic. They're just so natural.
Yeah.
When you began to cast the film, did you have that in mind? Maybe that we could do that. I'll cast sisters.
No. What happened was I went into the room looking for somebody to play my daughter, the six-year-old. And I saw this angelic face. And I'd written the other part older because it was very complex. And I asked the six-year-old to read the part, and I didn't know why I thought she could read, never mind act. And she read it perfectly, and I went, oh, my God. Maybe she'd be precocious and horrible, you know? And so I said, I'll ask another kid. So I went over to my daughter and said, is there anybody else here? And she said, that kid. And I asked the other kid to read it. And as she was reading it, my coat was yanked from behind. And I turned round, and Emma was looking at me with a look of pity, as if I'd crossed some invisible line of etiquette that I wasn't aware of. And she just said to me, Jim. And I said, yeah. And she said, is she reading my part? And I went, well, I was going to say, this is an audition. I was going to say, this is the way we do it. I was going to say, I'm sorry for, you know, maybe you shouldn't read. But I couldn't say any of it because I didn't want to break her belief. So I just stared at her to see would she flinch and break eye contact, which she didn't do. And I realized there was a little bundle of self-esteem standing in front of me. So I found myself saying, even though I knew it was the very first odd day of auditions and the very first child, I said, nobody's reading your part, your cast. And without a beat, she said, my sister's downstairs in the car. And I said, what age is she? And she said, 10. And I said, too young. And she said, well, you should see her anyway. So I went downstairs, met her, decided to rewrite the script, cast her. I didn't have to rewrite the script. She was so good. And on the first day of shooting, you know. I thought I'd get back into control on the set. And I went, action. Something went wrong and I went, cut. And the 10-year-old came out of the crowd and said, Jim, can I have a word? And I went, yeah. And she said, it's okay to curse in front of me. I'm 10. But my sister is only 6 and it's rude to curse in front of her. So I'm going to have to ask you to stop. So I was like, yeah. So I said, that's not going to happen. So she kept staring at me and I said, well, the only way out of this is that you'll have to take over and say action. And Emma can say cut whenever you want. And that's the way we did the film. And it was very interesting because there was no difference between acting and non-acting, reality and the set and whatever. But behind it, I've become to, maybe it's just getting back into my headspace. I kind of think there's a rage in me that wants to put the child back in control of the parents, or back in control of the adults, not the parents.
So did you have any of those problems that other directors have with kids on the set, that you have to make it more like play and keep it light and make the set a fun place?
Not really. I don't believe in that stuff. I think, you know, when people say don't work with children or animals, it's like, yeah, I get you. You know, it's such a sick sentence, you know. And it just betrays their feelings that children should be kept in their place, you know. They should be muted emotionally and grow up, like, messed up, you know. And I think that you're better off just, you know, those kids forced me to be honest. So rather than, like, the set is like I didn't have balloons or anything, you know, but the difficulty was when I was 2 weeks behind, Emma would ask me, what's for dinner, Jim? And I'd say, I think it's burgers. And she'd say, and is the white beans on today? And I'd be like, I think so. Yeah, she says, I like them, but what are they called? And I'm like, I don't know. And she'd go, and what are the red things with the strings? And I'd go, cranberries. And they were the kind of conversations I had to have. And it's very hard to have light conversations about reality when you're stressed out, you know? Huh. So it's actually a question of not saying, oh, God, we keep the kids happy and light and play. And it's more a question of respecting them as much as any adult or more. And imagining that, you know, the potential of a person reaches back all the way into the conception, you know.
And letting them be who they are, which is also children.
Yeah, letting them be who they are. It's like, It's the kids in this film are magical. The Sam Martin's fantastic, Paddy's great, Jaimin's great, and the kids are magical, and we all knew that, and we all stepped out of the way, you know. It's like when you have a holy thing happening, you don't mess with it.
Jim Sheridan's new film, In America, opens November 26th. Coming up, a remembrance of boxer and R&B singer Lee Dorsey. This is Fresh Air. F. Scott Fitzgerald said that there are no second acts in American lives, but you don't have to go any further than New Orleans to refute that. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the three acts in the life of Lee Dorsey: boxer, singer, and fender and body man.
When Mom and Papa first laid eyes on me, they knew right away.
breaking love is hard.
Breaking love is hard.
It was 1961, and Bobby Robinson, New York's top black record label owner, knew that something was happening in New Orleans because Fats Domino was selling so many records. Being so far away, he had no idea how to get a piece of it until his promotion man down there, Marshall Seahorn, called him and said he'd found a guy named Lee Dorsey. Robinson flew down and met the small, shy guy and discovered that he didn't have any material to sing. Pondering what to do, they sat on Dorsey's front porch and listened to some little girls play a clapping game, chanting, "Sitting on my la-la, yeah." Inspired, Robinson and Dorsey headed off to a bar where they had a few beers and wrote what would be Dorsey's first big hit.
Oh, well, I'm sitting here la-la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. I'm sitting in la la waiting for my ya ya. Oh. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming. Oh. Baby, hurry, don't make me worry.
Ya ya and its sound alike follow up, Do Re Mi, did well. But by 1963, Robinson had hit one of his periodic slumps and declared bankruptcy. Dorsey didn't mind. He was 37 years old, had a boxing career behind him, a wife and 11 kids to support, and a body and fender shop in New Orleans.
20 long miles from town, my old car broke down. The clutch is shot and the sun is so hot. Oh, what I'd give to be home. 19 miles. Battery's dead, man, like I said. Oh, what I give to be home. 18
In 1963, though, Marshall Seahorn called at Dorsey's wrecking yard with the news that he and Alan Toussaint had some great material and needed a vocalist. With Toussaint's funky piano up front and a cracking band behind, they recorded smash after smash. Ride Your Pony, Get Out of My Life, Woman, Working in a Coal Mine, and Holy Cow all did extremely well on both the R&B and pop charts for the next 3 years. But it was the last of this run of hits, recorded well after the others in 1969, when Dorsey was back banging out dents for a living, which predicted the future.
Everything I do gonna be funky from now on.
Yeah.
Everything I do gonna be funky from now on.
I just to be myself and do my thing. A little soul can't do no harm.
Yeah,
everything I do gonna be funky from now on. Yeah,
everything I do gonna be funky.
Yeah, from now on.
Yeah,
by 1970, both James Brown and Sly Stone had redefined black popular music. Classic old-time soul music was still strong, but the groove-oriented pull of funk was attracting more and more record buyers. Groove, of course, was a specialty of New Orleans, which drew a lot of its inspiration from the so-called second-line drumming of local funeral parades. In particular, a bunch of studio musicians Toussaint had gathered together, who called themselves the Meters, were doing great things. Toussaint had written a bunch of songs to go with these grooves. All they needed was a vocalist. A certain 44-year-old body and fender specialist came to mind.
Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another. Out of their problems and out of their quarrels, and try to live as brothers. And try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And do respect the women of the world. Just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land and a world in which we live.
And help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. I know we can make it. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes We Can was Lee Dorsey's last chart record. Actually, it only peaked in at the bottom of the soul charts. It was also the beginning of a string of amazing songs which Toussaint believed would break Dorsey as an important album artist. Instead, several of the songs did well for other artists. Yes, We Can was the Pointer Sisters' first hit 3 years later. Robert Palmer recorded Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley with the Meters. And Little Feat included On Your Way Down in their set. This last was from Dorsey's final album, Night People, which was released in 1977 after another stint in the Body Shop. It's a remarkable record, notable for socially aware lyrics and that patented New Orleans groove.
We may seem happy, like everything's all right. From the outside looking in, everything's uptight. But deep down inside, we're covering up the pain. It's a old thing, it's a soul thing, but it's a real thing. Way down, what's gonna happen to brother? Who's gonna help me make fun?
By now, Dorsey was in his 50s, and after Night People sank without a trace, he limited his performing to the annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival and a short tour with The Clash. After that, he stayed home, working on cars as he always had because, as he explained to a friend of mine, at least the money was regular. He died on December 1st, 1986, days before he would have turned 60.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Freedom for the stallion. Freedom for the mare and her coat. Freedom for the baby child who has not grown old enough to vote. About the people who are praying to you. They got men making laws that destroy other men. They made money gone, it's a doggone sin. Oh Lord, you got to help us find a way. Big ships are sailing, slaves all chained and bound. Headed for a brand new land that some cat said.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Art of the Bookplate, an illustrated history and celebration with a foreword by George Plimpton, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. And by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Colin Firth. He starred as Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice. In Bridget Jones' Diary, he played a part that was an homage to his portrayal of Mr. Darcy. Now he's co-starring in Love Actually. Join us for the next Fresh Air.